Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places with your host, Adam Bronstein.
Hello, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. I always like to remind my listeners that any views expressed on this program by me are mine and mine alone. If you're listening to this episode via web browser, I encourage you to exit out of that and pick up your phone and go to your favorite podcasting app. Search for Wilderness Podcast and look for the logo with the green bear. There you can subscribe. You'll get notifications of future episode releases. And you can also go back and listen to previous episodes. This episode came together very quickly. Yesterday, Thursday, October 29th, there was an announcement that the gray wolf has been removed for protection under the Endangered Species Act. This didn't come as a big surprise, but the exact timing was a little bit unknown. I reached out to Emmerich Weiss with the Center for Biological Diversity, and she was so kind to join me Friday evening. So I'm going to get this out here in a little bit, Friday night. So this will be the day after the announcement. I want to keep this in the press as long as possible. This is a huge news story. And I want to read to you a press release from Earth Justice. And this was out yesterday. Gray wolf stripped of federal protections. Fish and Wildlife Services removes the gray wolf from the Endangered Species Act, halting wolf recovery. Today, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finalized a rule removing protections for all gray wolves in the lower 48 states, except for a small population of Mexican wolves in Arizona and New Mexico. The rule proposed last year outraged Americans, with approximately 1.8 million comments submitted by the public opposing delisting. Additionally, 86 members of Congress in both the House and Senate, 100 scientists, 230 businesses, and 367 veterinary professionals submitted letters opposing the wolf delisting plan. Today, Dr. Jane Goodall released a video in response to the decision. Even the scientific peer reviews commissioned by the Fish and Wildlife Service itself found that the agency's proposal contained numerous errors and appeared to come to a predetermined conclusion with inadequate scientific support. Despite this public and scientific outcry, the rule issued today removes all federal protections for gray wolves. Emmerich Weiss is the senior West Coast wolf advocate with the center. We talk about the history of delisting, the assault on science, public opinion, cultural attitudes towards wolves, mass wildlife killing programs sponsored by the federal government, regional recovery status, state wildlife agency attitudes, emotionally connecting with wolves, next steps in the courts, about Emmerich's background, and about the Center for Biological Diversity. All right, let's jump right into the conversation. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you guys will share this around. All right, I'm Emmerich Weiss. We are rolling. Thanks so much for joining me today. And I really appreciate your time. It was sort of last minute, but we had some last minute news. So what happened yesterday?
Yesterday, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced once again that they're going to try to, strip protections from wolves from the Federal Endangered Species Act throughout almost the entire country. This is not the first time they've attempted it, but I'd have to say that in our analysis of this rule, it is probably the most devastating in terms of its impact for it happening now, how many wolves it would affect, but also just how blatantly it disregards current science and how blatantly it ignores the law and what is supposed to really happen to recover a species.
So was this a big surprise to you or anyone else in the conservation community?
It was not a surprise. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been attempting to either reduce protections for wolves federally or strip them of protections entirely all the way back to 2000. And I can go into detail about what some of those steps have been each time, but in specific to this particular action, the last time they tried to do it, to totally strip them of protections was in 2013. And at that time, they were going to remove protections from wolves everywhere throughout the lower 48, except for the Mexican wolf recovery area in the Southwest. And what happens when U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service puts out a rule like this, they frequently then have it undergo a peer review by credentialed scientists who are experts in taxonomy and genetics and wolf biology and ecology. And back in 2013, they totally interfered with their own process. When they found out who the scientists were that were going to be reviewing it, they booted several of them from the panel. And that got discovered, I think it was PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, that did a Public Records Act request and discovered what U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had done and outed that to the public. And Fish and Wildlife Service at that time had to admit, yes, we wrongfully interfered. They did an internal investigation. So then they contracted out to a different entity to find the scientists and put them on the panel. And they stayed away from interfering. But when the panel came out with its evaluation in, I think it was February of 2014, just not quite a year after they first proposed it, the scientists on that panel were strongly condemning of the proposal in that it did not abide at all by best available current science. So that kind of put a monkey wrench in their plans to move forward. And then they were waiting to see what would happen in a particular lawsuit that was also pending at the time over a delisting they had done of the three Great Lakes states, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And so later in 2014, a federal court found that the delisting that they had done there was illegal. And so I think those two things were kind of the nail in the coffin for that 2013 proposal. They didn't really know where to go with it after that. They didn't come forward with another proposal to delist until March of 2019. And we actually had gotten a heads up the year before, the summer before. Some of our staff had been in conversation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in summer of 2018 and realized that they were going to be coming out with another proposal within the next 6 months to a year. So when they came out with the proposed rule in March of 2019, we weren't surprised. We were prepared. And it takes about a year for them to then finalize the rule. It's taken them more than a year to do it in this case. And two of the reasons it took them so long to finalize this rule is, number one, the public outpouring and opposition to this was phenomenal. They received more than 1.8 million comments from the public opposed to the delisting. And once again, they had a scientist peer review panel review the rule, and it was strongly critical, again, of this rule. In fact, the scientists said it looked like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had a predetermined outcome. They intended to delist, and they were going to try to fit the science to make it justify their delisting. But the scientists said they've completely misinterpreted the science. This just doesn't stand up. Yeah, it wasn't a surprise, and it was kind of more of the same of what we've been seeing.
So they went scientist shopping, it sounds like.
Well, they didn't go scientist shopping. Back in 2013, they didn't like who they got and booted them. But then they realized that was a very bad PR thing to come out. And so they had an independent entity hire, contract with scientists. And then the same thing this time, they were not involved in the process of selecting the scientists. And both times they were panned by the scientists, and there wasn't anybody they could go to shop, because these people are experts in their field, and no matter what the federal agency might think of their science is their science. It's peer reviewed, it's published, it's reproducible. It's what we rely on to make all decisions about how we share this planet with other species on this earth, or it should be, at least.
Why do we have to fight the government to do what's right and to follow the science? how come the United States Fish and Wildlife Service isn't doing their duty under the Endangered Species Act?
That is not an easy question to answer. I will say, however, that they have placed upon them the same political forces that existed way back when in this country we first started wiping out wolves. You know, the livestock industry has always been a reason why we killed wolves in this country to begin with, and it still is. And that is still a very heavy-duty lobby that would like to see protections for wolves stripped so that ranchers and farmers can kill wolves. And, you know, this consists of the Cattlemen's Association, the American Farm Bureau Federation, the Sheep Growers Association, and any of the, you know, not just at the federal level, but at the state or county levels, in any state that has a wolf population or that could potentially have a wolf population. So you have that. I would say we have seen over the last maybe 1 to 2 decades a much stronger influence also coming in from the sports hunting lobby. So Safari Club International or Foundation for Fish and Wildlife or Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. They also have a very strong lobbying presence. So their power is felt. And then, you know, there's just the fact that this animal has had placed on its back this surrogacy of it. The wolf has come to represent hatred of government intervention into one's way of life if one does not approve of having a government or doesn't like to have government regulations or laws. And because the wolf has been protected under the Federal Endangered Species Act and in some states under their State Endangered Species Act, this means that there are certain things that are prohibited that didn't used to be prohibited. The Federal Endangered Species Act is the only reason that states were suddenly no longer allowed to kill wolves anymore. And so any of the right-wing think tanks, you know, think about the Koch brothers, the entities that they fund, they all kind of join on the bandwagon, too, in terms of funding efforts. Koch brothers funded this entity called Americans for Prosperity and then started up different state chapters like Californians for Prosperity or Oregonians for Prosperity. So they're made out to be like grassroots groups, but they're really not. These are artificial turf groups that are funded behind the scenes by big money that would like to see our country used for whatever we can extract from it, whether that's oil and gas, whether that's raising beef cattle on lands that really can't support cattle grazing. So it's much bigger than it seems. And then, of course, you have congressional representatives in the states that have wolves who, on their own, in between the many lawsuits back and forth of listing and delisting wolves, on their own will introduce bills in Congress to try to strip wolves of protection. And they were actually very successful in doing that in 2011. That's why a number of the western states lost wolf protections and could not be restored, because the law that was passed included a statement that this could not be appealed in court. So it's big. These are big forces we're battling.
Yeah, it seems like a total disregard for science. You know, the federal agencies, and like you mentioned, the cattle industry, and also the sportsmen. And this the sportsman side really doesn't sit well with me. I'm a hunter, and I just don't understand this kill mentality. Especially with predators. I think they have a place on the landscape. They're amazing creatures. And, you know, hunters just get such a bad rap. And I wish there was a larger voice of hunters standing up for this sort of thing. But let's get back to that anti-science. So if we're just looking at things through a utilitarian lens, it would seem to me that if you wanted to protect cattle, you know, killing wolves just doesn't make sense. They're really not the main food source, and it happens so rarely. You know, my understanding is that a lightning strike is more common than being killed by a wolf. Have you heard anything along those lines?
Yeah, you know, to put it in perspective, Adam, the state of Oregon has about 1.3 million cattle and about 150, 160 wolves. The state of Washington has 1.2 million cattle and may have as many as 145 wolves. California has over 5 million cattle and 14 wolves. The amount of predations by wolves on livestock is so infinitesimal that I think that I did the math once on how many livestock were lost due to wolves in Washington, and it ended up being something like 0.000009%. And part of the reason we know this too is even from data that's supplied by the farmers and ranchers themselves to the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They have a National Agricultural Statistics Service. And for years, every 5 years or so, they would put out a report that would be death loss causes for cattle and calves and a separate report of death loss causes for sheep and lambs. And what you see when you read those reports, and they go state by state, so they're going all across the country, you can see this, is that 90 to 95% of all livestock losses are due to factors that have nothing to do with any predator of any kind. Instead, 90 to 95% of the losses are due to things like dehydration, starvation, birthing complications, respiratory infections, eating poisonous weeds. Of the 5 to 10% of losses that come from predators, the majority are from coyotes, but after that is domestic dogs, dogs running wild in the countryside. And then after that, it will be bears or cougars, usually, depending on which state you live in. And then after that, it'll be a combination of bobcats, wolves, and eagles. Eagles eat sheep. The percentage is so small, I believe that the overall calculation of wolf-caused losses to cattle is 0.02%. So it's tiny, and you wouldn't know that from reading the headlines in Wolf Country, right?
You know, you just hear this discourse. I was reading some online forums last night in reaction to the wolf delisting, and everybody's just, at least the people who were vocal, were so amped up about now being able to kill these animals and that now the ranchers will be protected. But it seems to be a much deeper psychological phenomenon, I suppose you'd call it. And I had a previous episode with David Mattson and Louisa Wilcox, and we talked about some of this, and also George Werthner. We've talked about this as well, but just the kill culture, the domination over nature, you know, all these things are so deeply ingrained into some of the ethos and this mythology of the Western self-made man. And it just, it's so destructive, and it needs to change somehow. I mean, I really think that this is truly a culture issue. This isn't so much a scientific issue. You can show all the stats and talk about the science till you pass out, but it's just not going to change. How are we going to change our culture, and where does this come, you know, where are we going to be able to start to do that?
I couldn't agree more. You know, when I think about this, it just kind of wrap it up into the phrase of we are trying to come to terms with living once again with an animal that we tried to wipe from the face of the earth. So what kind of psychological mentality does that require to want to wipe an animal from the face of the earth? And you're right. It's more than just, do you know the facts? Do you care what the facts are? And it's a pretty fascinating subject. I can remember, maybe about 10, 12 years ago, there were some focal group studies done among men and women in Wyoming to learn their attitudes towards wolves. And when presented with, you know, a certain question, do you think that they kill all the elk and deer, or what percentage they do, and what they do with cattle and sheep? And then they would give an answer. And then when presented with the information about what the data actually showed, one of the things that I thought was seriously fascinating was that the men were more willing to change their mind and have a more open opinion towards wolves than the women were.
Whoa, no kidding.
Yeah, and you know, because we often adopt this view that women are going to be more nurturing and they're going to care for all little animals, and you know, it really drove home to me that no one should ever assume anything about another human being, because what was coming out here was the protective instinct. And so these women who were not willing to change their mind would say, no, I'm going to protect my children. And so it became very, very clear that the facts were not going to interfere with what they felt as a very primal need to protect their family. And it's important to know that people have those kinds of strong emotional views that will override facts, because if you don't even understand that that's something you're dealing with, then it's really hard to tease this out. And I think one of the other things that has not helped this situation is that for so many years, wildlife biologists and agencies, when it comes to wolves, have said that you have to be able to allow people to kill wolves in order for them to feel like they can coexist with them. And there was a federal court that just completely said, what? You have to kill a species in order to save it? That just doesn't even make sense. And it turns out nobody had ever really studied that before until a carnivore lab at University of Wisconsin started doing what are called longitudinal analyses, where every few years they would go back and survey the same people or the same groups of people in the state of Wisconsin to see what their attitudes were towards wolves over time as the wolf population grew and as protections were removed and put back in place because of lawsuits and then removed and put back in place. And whenever they were removed, the agencies could kill wolves and hunting seasons were open so that people could kill wolves. And what these studies showed was that allowing wolves to be killed actually decreased social tolerance for wolves. It made people more inclined to even kill wolves illegally, and poaching rates increased. And the scientists who evaluated this came to the conclusion that what may be happening is that when protections are removed for wolves and the agency can start killing them and people can start killing them as hunters or trappers, it sends a signal to the public that wolves really aren't so valuable. They really don't matter so much. And now we can just go back at them like we did before. So all along, agencies were just kind of operating from their gut and saying, we need to let people kill wolves to let off steam, and then they'll want to live with them. And that isn't the case at all. Once the science was done, and that isn't just in this country. The same stuff has been shown in, I believe it was either Sweden or Norway, a very similar study. So, you know, this is stuff we need to know to understand what we're dealing with.
Yeah, that's good. I'm questioning my own bias now about, the men and women viewpoints in terms of protecting wolves and killing wolves. I find that very fascinating. So thanks for expanding my mind on that particular issue. I want to talk a little bit about coexistence and the idea behind it. Is it merely enough to coexist with this wildlife as much as it is the same to tolerate somebody from another race? You know, we talk about tolerance and racism. Does that really go far enough?
In my book, absolutely no. We should be embracing wolves. Wolves are phenomenal animals. They're beautiful. They're magnificent. I'm sure your audience who's listening, I'm not having to tell anybody this, but you look at a wolf and the raw, wild beauty you see in that animal, you see how adapted it is to everything it does, every step it takes, and how hard it has to work to fight and to bring down prey, and its strong social family bonds. There's so much about wolves to love and admire. In my book, I don't think coexistence or tolerance goes anywhere near enough. I would love to see the world embrace having wolves.
Thank you. That's great. Yeah, I saw my first wolf in the Gros Ventre Wilderness in Wyoming. It was just an incredible experience. And I've seen them in the Lamar Valley in Wyoming, where a lot of people go to glass them up. But I feel that was a little bit more I don't know, Disneyland-like, but it was nice to be in the wilderness and to come across a wolf. It was a really world-changing experience for me.
And, tell me more about that. What was the exact experience?
Well, I was just hiking along, and it it ran up over a ridge, and it was very clearly a wolf. That feeling of vulnerability kind of comes over you a little bit, but then you stop and think that, okay, this animal is probably a lot more scared of me than I am of it. And then you also just think about the statistics and wolf attacks, and it's like, no, we're okay. But just having had that experience and also running across a wolverine before, it just it makes these places so much more magical and alive. And it's really the, you know, I've described this before as of others, but these large charismatic predators are really the heart and soul of our wilderness. And to see them go away, to me, is a destruction of wilderness. Not so much the place, but the spirit of wilderness is destroyed.
Yes, yes. I mean, the wolf is an animal that makes the wild wild. A wolverine is the animal that makes the wild wild. I'm jealous that you ran across a wolverine in the wild. How spectacular is that?
Yeah, the way that I came across it was a little scary, but fortunately it didn't jump on me. It ran away, but yeah, I thought I'd stepped into another dimension. It was just another shift in my brain. It was incredible to see that and to experience and to share the wilderness with a wolverine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's completely remarkable. Yeah, that's the moment that will stay in your being forever, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about wildlife services. So wildlife services does not get much media coverage. So now that we have a national gray wolf delisting outside of, was it the Mexican wolves, it just opens up all of this opportunity for wildlife services to kill, but also state game agencies. And we can touch on that in a little bit. But can you tell us what wildlife services is and what they do?
Yes, Wildlife Services actually is not a separate entity. It's not even a department. It is a program under the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which is sometimes abbreviated as USDA/APHIS. Wildlife Services is a program under USDA/APHIS, and it doesn't really have any regulations under which it has to operate. It's quite secretive. It used to be called Animal Damage Control, and then about maybe 20 years ago, changed its name to Wildlife Services. And I would say it does not service wildlife. It services the livestock industry, and it services other cities and towns, even to do things like kill geese and coyotes in towns. And this entity is funded, at least 50% of its activities are funded by federal dollars, which means your taxpayer dollars and my taxpayer dollars. They enter into contracts with different state or county entities to provide services. What those services usually are is the killing of wildlife and sometimes domestic animals on behalf of the livestock industry for the most part. And each year they put out a tally of all the wildlife they have killed and or domestic animals. And sometimes it includes endangered species. And we don't think that all of those even get reported. There have been a number of wildlife services former employees who come forward to comment on the many times that endangered species were accidentally killed and they were told to just bury them and not report it. So first of all, it's an outrage that our taxpayer dollars are going to kill all of this wildlife. Secondly, it's an outrage that they're killing all of this native wildlife on behalf of the livestock industry and also the agriculture industry in general. Birds, many different species of birds are killed in the hundreds of thousands as agricultural pests. And then you have pets that get killed by wildlife services. There was a very famous case a few years ago in Idaho where wildlife services had set in the ground these tools that are called M44s. It's a little injection device that you put in the ground. It just looks kind of like a small surveyor's stake. And if you got curious about it and you were a dog and sniffed at it, which you might do because they may bait it with something to draw in coyotes, if you pull on the little top, if you bite on it, it's going to shoot cyanide in your mouth. And this is a very excruciatingly painful death for whatever wildlife that happens to. In this particular case, it was set just not far off the property line at the backyard of this family. And this young boy and his dog were out there hiking around, and the dog bit into it, and the cyanide exploded in his mouth. And the boy tried to save his dog, and the boy ended up getting temporarily blinded and having other medical manifestations from that. The family ended up suing USDA Wildlife Services over it. They weren't going to stop using M44s. They ended up getting a settlement from Wildlife Services, and then other organizations, including ours, also sued USDA Wildlife Services to prevent them from using M44s there anymore. And I believe they are no longer using them in Idaho. We've had other states. Oregon, they weren't supposed to use them, but they did, and a wolf got killed when it bit on one that was set for coyotes. There are attempts at the upper level, you know, at federal congressional level and with the agency itself to stop the usage of M44s throughout the country. That has elicited a huge pushback from the current administration. So just that device alone is really appalling to think that that would be out there in places where anybody could come across it. I know of other cases, I think in Wyoming, not too long after the Idaho incident, two families were out hiking with their dogs, and two of their four dogs were killed by biting on M44s. These are terrible things to have out there in the public, but just in general, Wildlife Services, they do not perform a service. There are so many non-lethal measures that can be used to resolve and deter conflicts between livestock and wildlife. And in fact, Wildlife Service has its own research lab in Colorado that has pioneered and researched many of these methods, but it doesn't seem to translate to the field workers out on the ground.
Yeah, and they're gunning down wolves from helicopters, is my understanding.
Yeah, and you know, so the point that you raised earlier about how many wolves are being killed in Idaho by Wildlife Services, I happen to have in front of me the chart from Idaho, and I don't have this thorough of a chart for every other state, but this lists from 2009 through 2019 how many wolves have been killed in Idaho through hunting, through trapping, by Wildlife Services, by other unknown causes, by agencies killing wolves for what they call depredation control. And what I'm actually showing, this is as horrifying as it is what the Wildlife Services figures are, far more wolves in Idaho are getting killed each year in hunting and trapping seasons. Just in 2019, I believe that the records show from July 1st of 2019 through June 30th of 2020, 570 wolves were killed in Idaho. And out of that, this is for hunting and trapping, out of that, at least 35 of them were pups that were like 4 to 6 weeks old. This is barbaric. This is not sportsmanlike at all. There's nothing sporting about killing an animal in a trap. And there's nothing sporting about non-fair chase and hunting. And certainly gunning wolves down from a helicopter, I would not consider fair chase, nor would you. Idaho is kind of the poster child for how wildlife should not be treated. Wyoming comes a close second.
So the recovery of the gray wolf has been very uneven across the country. So it seems like California, Oregon, and Washington, it's been a little slower. Idaho, you've got major wilderness areas, so there's more places to hide, but you also had the seeding from the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I just read an article the other day before this new rule came out that the first gray wolf has left a pack in California and went up to Oregon. That was pretty exciting to read about.
You know, ordinarily that would just be just thrilling. And I think we're the ones that broke that news to the media. And ordinarily, yes, that would be just thrilling because what you want is to see wolves disperse from one state to the next. You can have this genetic exchange. The problem is with this federal rule now, which actually does not go into effect until January 4th, the wolves in Oregon, right in the area where that wolf walked into, is a part of Oregon that is still federally protected, but will have protections removed. So as few wolves as we have in California, I don't want any of our California wolves to wander into Oregon and face potentially being gunned down. I think it can get confusing for people to understand what parts of the country have protections and don't, and which ones allow wolf hunting or trapping or don't. Would we like to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Oregon seems like they're pretty predator friendly, aren't they?
It's a mixed bag. Oregon, the eastern one third of Oregon, is one of the states that got federally delisted in 2011. When Congress passed that legislation, they stripped wolves of federal Endangered Species Act protections in all of Idaho, all of Montana, the eastern one third of Washington, the eastern one third of Oregon, and a little notch out of north central Utah. And a year later, they stripped wolves of protection in Wyoming. And then that went back and forth in court and eventually ended up with them still being delisted. So it's happened in Oregon. And I think people like to think of the West Coast as very progressive. And in general, we are. Probably the three West Coast states have some of the most protective laws for domestic animals as well as for wildlife. But there are still these hardcore old philosophies of dominating nature that prevail in politics in the state and have an outsized voice in politics in the state compared to what most of the citizens actually feel like towards wildlife. So in Oregon, it developed a state plan in 2005. It's supposed to get updated every 5 years or so. I used to live in Oregon, so I was on the stakeholder group that helped advise the agency on that plan, and it was a very progressive plan compared to the Northern Rockies. Unfortunately, because of some of the politics in Oregon, some of the same forces I spoke of, although wolves had been state-listed in Oregon, they were prematurely state-delisted in 2015. And then the federal protections had been removed in the eastern part of Oregon in 2011. So that has meant that all along, the agency has been able to kill wolves for wolf livestock conflicts in the eastern one third of the state. Now, if you want to talk about things in terms of relativity, I would say that ODFMW, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, has for the most part been much more judicious in its use of killing wolves for conflict resolution than, say, compared to the Washington State Wildlife Agency, which has just been completely irresponsible in that respect. But part of the reason that Oregon became that way is because initially the wolf plan was good, and then they began to ignore the wolf plan because they got a lot of pressure from the livestock industry to move to kill wolves more quickly than the wolf plan allowed. And when we found that out, we and two other groups sued the state. And as a result of that lawsuit, got much stronger protections for wolves in place during the phase one early stages of recovery there. And the other thing that has been helpful in Oregon is that the agency staff that manage wolves tend to view wolves as a species that needs to be conserved and recovered. And this is not the case in Washington, where wolves are not managed by their endangered species staff, but are instead managed by their game management division staff. And that's a very different lens to look at a species when you're making management decisions.
So what do the populations look like overall today across the country? And I guess, so Colorado now is voting on wolf reintroduction down there. So, yeah, go ahead.
That's really exciting. Very exciting. So population-wise, there's probably a little over 6,000 wolves right now in the lower 48. And to some people, that might sound like a lot, but if you live in some states that have like 30,000 bears or 5,000 cougars just in one state, you know that 6,000 wolves across the country is nothing. And you know, there were once an estimated 2 million wolves across North America when Europeans came here. In fact, in the western United States and Mexico alone, we had about 380,000 wolves. So 6,000 wolves across the country isn't much. Most of them are in the western Great Lakes states, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin. There's about 4,000 wolves there. Then there's probably another 1,500 to 1,800 wolves in the northern Rockies. And then we've got about 150 wolves in Oregon, 150 in Washington, and 14 in California. And then down in the southwest, there's the Mexican wolf population, which I think is around 130 now. Every year that population gets hammered back by a lot of poachings, and then it might climb up like another 10 wolves or so, and then it gets hammered back again the next year. So I'm going to say maybe about 130 wolves there now.
Well, we're not far off from extinction if these programs continue, if the trapping continues, if hunting continues, if wildlife services continues. We're on a path to extinction, I suppose, outside of Yellowstone right now.
Well, this is the thing that is so maddening about this rule stripping protections from wolves. The Department of Interior, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is declaring that this is a huge success and that we've reached recovery and we can take the patient out of the emergency room is their example that they give. But, you know, what they've said in their rule, and they've literally said this in the rule, is that because we have all these wolves in the Great Lakes states, it doesn't matter that there's a few wolves in Washington and Oregon, California. Those wolves don't matter to the continued recovery or the sustainability of the population. That completely flies in the face of conservation biology, which teaches you that in order to have a population of any species that's going to be sustained into the future, to the next 50 years, to the next 100 years, you have to have multiple populations in the habitats they once used to live in. You have to have ability for genetic exchange between those different far-reaching populations in order for them to withstand any catastrophic events, any disease events, in order to overcome whatever changes may happen with climate change and how that's going to affect wolf prey and their ability to find prey. So the federal government's idea of what constitutes recovery, it just flat out isn't supported by science. You're absolutely right. You know, having just stopped here, well, think about it this way. Remember I mentioned before that for about 2 years, there was a period where wolves were delisted in the western Great Lakes states, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And during that time, they had 2.5 seasons of hunting and trapping before the court reversed that delisting. And in that 2.5 seasons, from fall of 2012 to December of 2014, they killed between a third and a half of their wolf population across the whole three states. That's how quickly they were able to knock back numbers of what is supposedly a robust wolf population. And so this is the real fear with delisting, is that any states that have a semblance of a wolf population now is going to immediately go back and do the aggressive hunting and trapping. And states that don't have wolf populations, but where wolves could disperse into to establish a population or need to disperse through to get to another state where there's more wolves, all of those states are just going to immediately allow wolf killing. Right now, the Dakotas, they have one of the states there has this on its books that wolves are designated as predatory animals that can be shot on sight. That's same true for the state of Wyoming in 80-85% of the state. They don't even have to have a hunting season. If you see a wolf, you can kill it. And the other 15% of the state, they have a hunting season. So, yes, all of these populations are still really vulnerable. This is still just the infancy of recovery. We got a long ways to go.
And the technology we have today is so much greater than that we had at the turn of the century when we already went through this whole rigmarole. What was the population like at its absolute lowest?
So pretty much by the 1930s, we had exterminated just about all of the wolves across the lower 48. But by 1973, which is when the Federal Endangered Species Act, as we know it today, was passed, there were some earlier iterations of the Endangered Species Act in the late 60s, for the listeners who might not know that. But by the time the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973, all that was left in the lower 48 was less than 1,000 wolves, and they were all up in far northeastern Minnesota. And I'm originally from the Midwest, and I think any of us who've lived in cold weather country like Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, or the northern Rockies, you know, my theory is the only reason that they weren't all killed up in northeastern Minnesota, it was just too freaking cold for humans to stay up there and wipe out that last 1,000 wolves. But that was it. You know, the Mexican wolf recovery program in the Southwest in Arizona and New Mexico, the Mexican wolf is a separate subspecies of gray wolf, and there were none of those left. Scientists had to capture 7 founding individuals in Mexico to bring them into this country to start a captive breeding program in order to be able to start to try to recover that subspecies of wolf. So we did a very good job of wiping them out. You know, wolves, unlike coyotes, because they tend to live in family groups, it was so easy for wolfers at the turn of the century to wipe out whole family groups. You know, all you had to do was poison a bison carcass, and the whole wolf pack would come to feed on it, and they'd all be killed. And
they're so vulnerable right now.
They are. Yeah, they truly are. And our politics just doesn't take that into account. So, but the thing is, the American people should take that into account. Survey after survey, Adam, has shown that people really support the Endangered Species Act, really want to see wolves back. They want to see them recovered. And in fact, you mentioned Colorado. So that's on the ballot next week to have the state reintroduce wolves. And the surveys done there show that 84% of people in Colorado support wolf reintroduction, which is fantastic and unsurprising, really. Because if you talk to real people on the ground, mostly they get it.
Yeah, I mean, the public opinion outside of direct, ballot measures, when that's enacted, direct democracy, I suppose it doesn't really phase the government all that much. I mean, look at the Tongass. They had like 96% of comments come in favor of keeping the roadless rule up there, and that was just overturned. So it's
right.
It just keeps coming at us, you know, the pebble mine and Alaska's, I don't want to get off topic here too much, but Alaska is really a case in point to all this. It's just completely ignoring public opinion. And same with the wolves. But at the end of the day, they have to look at the science, and public opinion seems to align with the science. So,
yeah. Anybody that's paying attention to the issues closely, if they read, you know, and this gets us back kind of full circle back to what we talked about at the beginning. You know, those facts, they're really important. But at the same time, I think the point that you made of the emotional appeal, you know, the symbolism of wolves and how people connect to them is equally important. And, you know, sometimes I worry that the public will get wolf fatigue because we have to keep fighting these battles over and over and over. Every time we win something, then something gets overturned. But I think that the overwhelming arc of history is on our side on this issue. And yeah, the battle's going to be uneven and uncertain, and sometimes we'll have major victories and sometimes we'll have setbacks. But I think everything I've seen, even some of the studies in terms of public attitudes of putting aside that whole idea of dominion, more and more public attitudes towards wildlife actually is of mutualism and of appreciation for the fact that it's all connected, and whatever happens to them is going to happen to us, and they have intrinsic value all on their own, no matter what we think of them. So I grapple with the darkness of this all the time, but I also have tremendous hope.
Yeah. Wolves and wilderness and grizzly bears and all these things are so bigger than ourselves, and they almost run counter to our dominant culture of consumerism and the self. And I think that once we can step out of that a little bit and look at what we have, all of a sudden we start to find some meaning in these shared resources and, like you mentioned, intrinsic value. You know, these are real rallying points and give us an opportunity to really step outside of ourselves.
Yes, absolutely true.
What's your connection with wolves? How did you get involved with wolf conservation? And then I want to talk a little bit about the center when we're done with that question.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned before, I grew up in Iowa. So I grew up in a state that I learned every year in school once had vast prairies and once had bison and grizzly bears and wolves. And obviously by the time I was growing up there, we didn't anymore. But so I always had this kind of image in my head of what the past must have been like there. And I've always been very connected with canines, domestic or wild. My mother tells me that when I was 4, I announced to her and my dad that I was never having babies. I was only having puppies. And I kind of stuck to that. I went on to become a biologist. My background actually is in entomology. I happened to go to Iowa State University for undergrad, which was the only undergrad school in the country that had an entomology program, degree program. And what I loved about it was the only field that I was, as I was shopping around in the natural sciences, was connecting all these different pieces. So, like, you didn't just study insects. You also studied plants, and you studied plant pathology, and you studied soil. And I wasn't really seeing that in any other course, and that was the thing that really intrigued me, this concept that there's just not one piece in nature. You might really love insects, or you might really love wolves, or whatever, but it's all connected to everything else. And so that spurred my interest. I went on and got a master's in entomology as well. And then I went to law school, came out to California planning to become an environmental attorney. But I learned that environmental attorneys sit at their desks and read code books all the time. And I wanted to be in court, damn it. I've been in theater most of my life, and I wanted to go argue my case. So I became a criminal defense attorney for a decade. I was a federal public defender and then an appellate criminal attorney. And then one day I read my second most important wolf book. Back in the 70s, I read Barry Lopez's book the year after it came out, Of Wolves and Men. And that was a really fundamentally important book for me to learn about wolves.
I love
and
Barry
then 20
Lopez.
Years later, have you read it?
I haven't read that one, but I love his writing.
He's amazing. I had an opportunity to meet him here in person a couple years ago. He spoke with his release of his most recent book, Horizons. What an amazing person. But so in 96, I read another fundamentally important book for me, and that was Wolf Wars by Hank Fisher. And that's when I learned through that book that even though wolves had been listed in 1974, it still took another 20 years of political battles to get wolves reintroduced to Yellowstone in central Idaho. And I thought, God, this is really fascinating from a legal and a science perspective and a social study and returning a species that we tried to kill off. And I lived very near a wolf conservation center, and I went out there one day and said, hey, I'm a biologist, I'm a lawyer, I love wolves, how can I help you? And they had me start giving talks to the public on all the Yellowstone lawsuits that were happening at the time. And then I got a job with Defenders of Wildlife. I worked for them for 8 years. I did a bunch of work for California Wolf Center and the Mexican Wolf Conservation Fund. And then in 2013, I got hired by the Center for Biological Diversity to work specifically on West Coast wolves. So I've had incredible opportunities to work on wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies, in Alaska, in the Southwest, and in the Pacific West. And over the course of more than 20 years, have just had the ultimate pleasure of working with so many other dedicated people who feel the same way you and I do about wild places and about wild animals like wolves. And so that's how I'm doing what I'm doing. I don't work as a practicing lawyer for the center. I'm more of a policy wonk, I guess. But I get to use my legal lens and my biology lens to view what I see is happening with wolves and what we can do to help them.
Great. Now, one question before we talk about the center. I want to get back to wolves. Well, we've been talking about wolves the whole time, but I want to get back to the gray wolf delisting. What can be done in court to challenge this decision?
So the Endangered Species Act requires the service to recover species if they are still threatened in significant portions of their range. And they are still threatened in significant portions of their range. So they can't delist them now. It's quite clear that significant portions of their range, not only are they threatened there, they don't even yet exist there. So you have legal arguments based on what the actual listing and delisting criteria are of the Endangered Species Act. But you also have the science arguments, because the Endangered Species Act requires that those listing decisions be based on best available science. So the 245-page report that the peer review scientist panel put together will also be something that is presented as argument to the court to show that the service's decision violated the Endangered Species Act in that respect as well. And so this really is a case that is going to have to come before the court, because people, you know, ask me, what can we do now to stop this? You know, when the proposal came out in 2019, everybody went full bore on making sure that we had as many public comments submitted to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as possible, so there would also be a record for the courts of how much the public supports wolf recovery and understands that they're not yet recovered. So back in 2013, actually I've seen this cycle happen three times now. So back in the early 2000s, when the first delisting or downlisting proposal came out, 90,000 comments were submitted, and 95% of those were opposed to reducing protections for wolves. That's 90,000 comments. Fast forward to 2013, almost 1 million comments were submitted opposing wolf losing their protections. And now fast forward again to 2019, 1.8 million comments were submitted opposing. So, public perception towards wolves and public awareness that they need continued protections, although it feels, hopeless to people in the public, just getting those comments in actually helps build the record to be able to show to the court, because many people's comments, do contain scientific information in them. This rule does not go into effect until January 4th. So although they made the announcement yesterday, it won't get published in the Federal Register until next week, November 3rd, I believe is the date they've said, and then it goes into effect 60 days after that, which would be January 4th. So right now, because what we know this means that wolves will be turned over to state management while the court battle fight, plays out, we are asking everybody to sign letter petitions that we have put together online. We've got it on our Facebook page for Center for Biological Diversity. And we will be sending those letter petitions to governors in the key states where wolves will be most at risk. So, for instance, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, also Oregon, Washington, California, also Utah, also Colorado, any of the places that either wolves already are or could be dispersing through. And these will be urging the governors to do what they can at their state to not allow the state to have a hunting and trapping season. and to keep some level of protection or institute some level of state protection if they don't already have it for wolves. So right now, you know, full bore press, what we're trying to do is get folks to sign these so we can send hundreds of thousands, maybe a million or more signatures to all of these governors.
And if we have an unfriendly court, let's say, you know, maybe even the Supreme Court, like what can, let's say, a Biden administration or a Democratic Congress do in the face of this?
So, you know, one of the things that presidents are able to do, and I'm not able to talk specifically about names of candidates because that's electioneering and I work for a 501c3, so I'm just going to talk generically about what an administration can do. And that is that in terms of rules that have been put into place X number of days or X number of months before the new administration comes into place, they could overturn those rules. Whether or not this next administration would do that, I'm not sure. There have been Democratic congressmen and congresswomen who have also supported delisting legislation that was introduced into Congress. So it's not just the Republican congressionals who have proposed to strip wolves of protection. And so one of the key things that we need to keep doing and what we've been having people do all along is contact their congressional Democrat or Republican and tell them, we do not want you to introduce any act to that would keep this delisting in place. You know, be sure that doesn't happen. Be sure no legislation is adopted that has a rider on it like happened back in 2011, because that's how that legislation happened. Congress was going to pass a Department of Defense appropriations bill. That's the kind of bill that's going to pass no matter what's attached to it, because it's such an important bill. And congressionals attached a rider to it that delisted wolves in those states that I mentioned and put a provision in there that said this can't be appealed in court. And that was taken to court, and the court said, no, it can't be appealed in court. It's right there in the congressional language. So it will be really essential for people to be in touch with their congressional elected officials and say, we, your constituents, do not support this delisting. We want you to do everything you can in your power to overturn it. Maybe that means congressional legislation to overturn it, or maybe that means just making sure that no language gets inserted that says this can't be overturned in court.
Okay, thanks for that background. Well, let's wrap things up here pretty soon. I appreciate all your time with me on this Friday. Let's just tell me about the Center for Biological Diversity and what you guys do, and also your website and where you can be found.
Sure. Center for Biological Diversity has been around since, right before the beginning of the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program, because that's the reason that our organization started. We used to be called the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity, and the organization was founded in order to protect the Mexican gray wolf and the Mexican spotted owl. So we've been around for over 30 years, maybe 32 years now. And our headquarters is based in Tucson, Arizona, but we do have satellite offices around the country. Of course, all of us are working from home offices these days. I always have. Many of us also just work from home offices. So we're scattered around the country. We have main office in Oakland, in Seattle, in Washington, D.C., in somewhere in Florida, also in, I think, Asheville, North Carolina. But the rest of us are stationed everywhere around the country. And I would say that most of us that work for the center are either biologists or attorneys or both. Of course, we also have an incredible team of people that do technical work, our communications team and our social media team. And we work on everything from freshwater mussels to the dugong in Japan to wolves here to trying to stop fracking. We have a climate law institute. We've been very integral in being at the climate treaty meetings. We work a lot with indigenous communities to stop the horrific desecration of their sacred lands that is being caused by oil and gas development, pipelines. We have a bent towards saying our work is done through science and the law and creative media. And part of that creative media is a recognition that you can get a lot done that way. And I think that we really kind of pioneered many of the webinars that more and more groups are using these days to help educate people, which is a fantastic tool. So we have a program called Saving Life on Earth. And several times a month, we've got a webinar on a different issue. It might be stopping trophy importation and hunting from other countries coming to the United States and stopping the trophy hunting in other countries. It might be on, we have a population and sustainability program. We actually have 9 different programs within the center. And the population and sustainability program is one I really, really love, because we're one of the few groups that has really focused on how the human population has impacts on quality of life on Earth. And one of my favorite programs out of that is we have endangered species condoms. And that doesn't mean they're for the endangered species. It's just that each condom box has a different endangered species on it and a little poem about it. And those are big hits when you give talks on college campus. They're great stocking stuffers, too.
So yeah, it's thinking outside of the box, huh?
Yes, yeah, definitely. And people appreciate that. You know, these issues are all so serious and so tragic, and there's so many battles to be fought that you also have to bring a little bit of levity into it. And we love nothing better than sending boxes of condoms to congressional representatives who vote against environmental protection. we love doing that. So we take a lot of different approaches. And just feel very, very deeply that the quality of human life is intrinsically related to the health and well-being of the planet. And we're fighting for the health and well-being of the planet.
Well, you guys do a fantastic job, and you have right along, even with your staff growing so large and your mission has really stayed intact. So I really appreciate that about you guys.
So, thank you. Yeah. We've exploded in staff numbers just since I've been with the center.
Yeah, scrolling down that page is like, it's crazy. It just keeps on going. So good for you guys. Well, listen, Emmerich, thanks for your time. This was really informative. I learned a lot today, and I know the listeners will as well. So we'll get this out really soon to keep up the press on this breaking story. And it's been great chatting with you. So again, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, you're welcome. I was thrilled when you reached out to us, and because I've listened to some of your podcasts, and you have fascinating people on there who've got great experience. So thank you. It's an honor to be reached out to.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Me too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.